welcome to the 7th edition of the Media Chwitz. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali, founder of Paid Content, and two new travel startups. How are you doing, Rafat?
I'm good, thanks. I have a bad case of allergies, so if I sound half dead, it's not because of my startups, it's because of my allergies.
Yeah, it gets that way in the spring, huh?
Yeah. It's apparently New York has the worst allergens or whatever season in history this year. So people, I've never had allergies before. This is the first time having it. So, and that's not just me. It's a lot of people that I know. First time ever.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Yeah, we haven't yet invented an app that can cure that or something.
We'll work on it.
Yeah, so, that's my next time.
So the big news for me is that I've decided to cut the cord from cable. I know we've talked about it before.
When did that happen?
Well, I'm moving to a new place, and that's when it became possible. You know, in moving, you know, that seemed to be the natural cutoff point, where, you know, should I get cable at this new place? Should I get satellite? Should I just forget about cable? And so it just seemed like there are too many ways to get everything I wanted. Either via the web, via Roku, Netflix. Now with the iPad, I'm noticing there's a lot I can get on iPad. So it just felt like redundant to have. It felt ridiculous to pay that much to have 500 channels where I watch maybe two or three.
And you're not a sports guy, in general.
Well, I am a sports guy, and I think that was the hardest one. But I think there's enough kind of streaming things out there and ways to find that content that, you know, made me feel like, you know, and plus there's over-the-air broadcasts, there's some of that. So we'll see. I mean, that might be the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, but over-the-air is quite a lot of channels apparently. Like somebody was telling me they get 25 channels somewhere in West Coast that they live. I'm forgetting who it was, but and that would take care of most of the big games. On network TV and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Like, let's say football, you know, there's the network games, and then I guess it's with, you know, your typical kind of baseball games are on cable. Some of them are on broadcast, so it varies, but you know, I'll just have to figure out the workarounds and see how much I really care. My son, my 8-year-old son Julian, he seemed to be the one probably the most upset about losing, you know, DVR of all the shows that he likes. But I have a feeling he'll be able to find those online.
Yeah, and how old is he?
He's just about to be 9, 8,
oh, okay,
going on
so
9.
You can put the iPad in front of him and give him YouTube. He'll find whatever he needs to.
No question. The iPad has a lot of potential for him. And, you know, we just started playing around with GarageBand to play music. And there's this video app called ShowYou that has all, you know, where you can get all the video from YouTube that your friends recommend. That's kind of cool. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to entertain us, you know, with the web, I'm hoping. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I think the cutoff point happens, which is what happened to me, the same as happened to you, is when you move. And I moved from LA to New York. And that's when I cut the cord about a year and a half ago, more than a year and a half ago. And I guess it's happening for you now.
Yeah, is there anything you miss?
No. I don't miss anything about it. I'm very happy that I have a lot more time in my life to not have background crap. So really, that's just what it is. And I get all the news I need to. I mean, you and I have talked about this in the past. We get all the news we need to. So
yeah, we're inundated just with the web. So
yeah. And between Roku, Netflix, Apple, Amazon, I'm set pretty much.
So. Yeah, do you do Roku or do you do the Apple TV
Roku.
Or both?
I actually have both, but I'm increasingly using Roku. Apple, I haven't even plugged in a bit because Roku has Hulu Plus, Roku has Netflix as well, which Apple has, and I don't pay for iTunes anything. So, and it also has Al Jazeera streaming, CNN International, BBC streaming, and some other international Indian stuff as well, which I'm interested in. So Roku really has become the box for me, even though the UI isn't as great, but it still has a lot more.
So here's the rundown for today's show. We're going to talk about the big acquisition, Microsoft buying Skype for $8.5 billion. Will, you know, Microsoft figure out a way to make money with Skype, which no one else has really done? Then our guest will be Laura Rich, who's the co-founder of Street Fight, the hyper-local publication that we were poo-pooing a little bit. She'll come on and tell us that we're wrong and why we're wrong. And then finally, we'll talk about Google has just announced that it's unveiling Chromebooks, kind of a low-end netbook that only runs the web and nothing else, no software, and whether it has a chance. So first, let's talk about Microsoft and Skype. Obviously, we're using Skype for this podcast, and we're both pretty, you know, regular users of Skype and have used it for a while for video. I've used it for video conferencing for sure, and for just calling people and overseas calling. It's great. It's an awesome service, and it's you know, it works. But is it a moneymaker? I mean, that's been the big question, right? It was founded in 2003. It was sold to eBay for $2 billion plus. And eBay couldn't figure out what to do with it, so some private investors came in and bought 70%. And now Microsoft is swooping in, ostensibly to keep it from the hands of Facebook or Google, and buying it for a huge premium, 400 times what the operating expenses are, right?
Yeah, no, it's a huge sum, and huge exit for. I mean, as a consumer, my biggest hope is that just keep your hands off it and just let at least the main part of what it is, like the daily stuff that you and I use, just let it be. And I don't want integration of any Microsoft stuff. I have no desire to use any Microsoft stuff. I'm fine as it is. I use Microsoft on my laptop and I'm keep using it, whatever. I just don't want any big integration. But I think for Microsoft, the key here, from what I understand, is that it may not by itself be a huge revenue generator for Microsoft. I think what it does for all sorts of businesses within Microsoft is probably what their hope is. So the benefits will be across the company and across various business lines and across future product lines that everybody else, I mean, everybody has written about it. So it's not like I'm telling this the first time, but all the businesses like gaming or Office or Outlook Express and Outlook and all this other stuff and their phone business stuff, particularly if this works in their mobile phone business and helps them compete against Google and Apple and the others, that would be, I mean, that alone would be a huge win for Microsoft.
But wouldn't it, you know, I guess I understand that, and I get the idea of synergy and trying to build it into all their products. And I mean, it's a little similar to what eBay thought, you know, let's build it into auctions. And this seems a little bit more direct because it's into things like phones and an Xbox and things that actually, you know, people do communicate with. But wouldn't that upset the carriers? I mean, isn't that always the issue with the phones and tablets, that if you put in Skype and make it very easy, very cheap to communicate, then, you know, that takes away from what the carriers are selling with their minutes?
Yeah, true. But I think carriers, I mean, that boat has already sailed for carriers, because that the cost of communication, person-to-person communication, has been falling down. People will find ways around it, whether carriers want it or not, and they have to be open to it. And they have been, because apps like, well, the Skype app on iPhone or Android and others, and all the other alternatives to it as well, Google's own stuff in it, Google Voice and stuff, is finally on iPhone and things like that. So that boat has already sailed for operators. And so I think Microsoft long term probably realizes that and is willing to take that bet.
Yeah, what about the worry about, as consumers, you know, people who are using it, and the possibility that Microsoft, you know, one of the way, you know, when you were saying you're kind of like hands off my Skype, I mean, one of the things they could do is, you know, when we're using this kind of free service, you know, right now, in fact, you know, we could just have ads popping up, you know, while we're using Skype, while we're doing a video conference. I'm guessing that would be an easy way to start making money if you've got hundreds of millions of people using it.
Yeah, they probably will do something. I mean, I don't know what your thought. I mean, what would you be open to it?
I mean, if it meant the long-term survival of the service, I guess you have to consider that, right? I mean, I guess I would be open to it if it was very targeted, discreet, not in the way, but then, I wouldn't be paying attention to it. So I don't know. I don't like the when it comes to advertising, I'm not a big fan of the kind of dumb, in-your-face pop-up solution. I'm much more about, give me something that's very targeted and very specific and, and when I want it, at the time that I expect it, maybe upon, let's say, log into Skype or log out of Skype or something, at a time where it's not going to be in my face so much when I'm trying to use the service.
Yeah, for me, I'm a user. I'm a paid user of Skype. I buy Skype credits all the time because I travel myself, and so I use the app on iPhone a lot. I call India and UK and all the other places that I usually call if I'm traveling through Skype. So I'm a user of Skype and not just a free user. So
Right. So I guess our hope is that we just don't have the Microsoftication of Skype, whatever you want to call it.
Softification of Skype, yeah. So
I don't know. And it's funny, the whole thing with Ballmer saying, well, Skype is a verb, and that means it's really part of the lexicon and part of the way people communicate now, and we really want to be a part of that. But I don't know if that really means it's worth that means it's worth extra billions of dollars or not.
yeah, I mean, I think the main thing was keeping it out of Google's hands, and which there were, as you said in the at the start, and that was, I guess, one of the big reasons why they paid the premium for it. Facebook, yes, but Facebook will, because Microsoft is a Facebook investor, they'll get access to it. So Facebook will be able to integrate it in ways that they want to. Probably not all the ways, but most of the ways that they want to.
So Laura Rich has covered the bubbles and busts at Condé Nast Portfolio.com, the Industry Standard and Recession Wire, which she co-founded in 2009. She had a Sunday interview column in the New York Times and authored the Paul Allen biography, The Accidental Zillionaire. She led coverage of small businesses and startups for Inc. and Fast Company, and consults with startups on media strategy and lives in Boulder, Colorado. She's the co-founder of Street Fight, the new publication that is looking inside the business of hyperlocal. Welcome to Media Twits.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So first tell us, just give us a little bit of background. You've done a, you know, you were at the Industry Standard, you've been at a lot of publications covering technology. What is it about hyperlocal that got you motivated to start this site? What was it about that specific area?
Sure. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Industry Standard, because in some ways we see this as a mini version of what was happening when the Industry Standard launched. We saw right now, we saw a lot of new companies popping up, a lot of money being thrown at them, and everybody trying to figure out, along with some changing consumer behavior, and people trying to figure out what are the sustainable business models. And you could argue that maybe no one was actually trying to figure out sustainable business models back when we were at the Industry Standard, but they are trying to do that now. And we saw that there's a lot happening in the local space. There's a $150 billion local advertising market, and all of a sudden it's much more efficient to reach local advertisers and local audiences. It's also more efficient for local advertisers to get to their customers as well. And so we saw this as a land grab and a turf war going on, and that's where the name Street Fight came from, because we saw that there was a battle for the local advertiser and the local audience. And so we thought there was a real need for something like Street Fight, and we're getting, that's sort of the feedback we're getting from the industry, that there is a need for something like this.
And what, and so tell us a little bit about your plan and how, you heard us talking about it earlier, and we were a little bit kind of questioning, is there enough out there to support what you're doing as a publication? What are you seeing something different than we were? I mean, maybe give us kind of a rough outline of what your business plan is.
Sure. Well, we see ourselves as kind of a service business, or as someone, said recently, a utility business, although then you start thinking about like electricity and things like that, and we're not in that business. But we are out to serve this industry, and the website is the first thing that we launched. So we launched that on April 13th, and that will continue to be a very important focus for us, and will chronicle the evolution of this industry and help surface good ideas and smart people. And you know, give some strong analysis of what's going on. We'll do that on our site. We'll run ads there. Federated Media is actually selling our ads, and but then we'll also be offering research and events. We had our first event last night in New York, a small event, and we'll have a big conference in August or September that we're putting together now. And we're also putting together a think tank, and we'll be rolling out an industry directory that we've been getting a lot of clamoring for.
Yeah, and I saw that you're going to be doing research as well.
Oh yeah, our proprietary research is going to be a big part of what we do. I mean, we look at BIA Kelsey, which is which produces a lot of research around local advertising, and they're in the space, and we'll be doing some stuff that's probably a little similar to theirs, but there's a market and a hunger for that. We've been hearing that. There's a lot of interest around really understanding this market of the local merchant. How do you get to them? What do they really want when it comes to these various hyperlocal options? So that's some of what we'll be doing. But we do plan to do like a few sort of huge stake in the ground reports a year, and then smaller reports throughout. So that'll be a big part of what we do.
This is Rafat. So I guess one of the reasons why we sort of dismissed it, and I think you mentioned it, not dismissed it, but we were poo-pooing a little bit, was the fact that hyperlocal hasn't succeeded till now. And I guess we're looking at hyperlocal publishing efforts, but I think what you're describing is more to do with commerce and stuff, which I guess is where the real opportunity is, as opposed to sort of publishing about local area stuff.
Well, that's right. But I think we're also starting to see a new era for that. And I'm really interested to see, you know, people poo-poo Patch and AOL's hyperlocal effort. And that's fine. And we do as well. But I think that the election will be really interesting in terms of how that model works. We covered how AOL used Patch in their coverage of the death of Osama bin Laden. They used it a little bit like a wire service. Now, it doesn't mean anything about it being a great business model, but it might be the thing that proves hyperlocal publishing's merit. However, from the business model standpoint, I think we're also seeing other experiments in what you can do. There's a company called Nearsay, which is based in New York, and they're just in New York right now, but I think they have 8 neighborhood hyperlocal sites, and they are just abandoning the CPM advertising approach altogether and merging with the daily deals model. And so to get to what you just said about how we're focusing on the commerce aspect of it, we're seeing that happening across all of what we're calling hyperlocal, including the hyperlocal publishing. So, you know, that's why we think there's a lot happening there, and a lot to be figured out. And when there's a lot to be figured out and a lot of people trying something, there's an opportunity there to help them, whether it's chronicling what they're up to or providing research or events for them to come together. And so, yeah, that's what we're doing. I mean, Rafat, isn't your business sort of similar in a way? You know, you've got many different arms of what you're doing to support the media industry.
Well, my business I sold and I left a year ago. But... Okay. And that's the way to support it. One of the other questions I had was, why did you decide to name it like Mag or something like that?
Oh, okay, that's a great question. I mean, streetfight.com was not available, so we started off with streetfightmag.com for the website. But I agree that can create some confusion. About the fact that we're going to have other lines of business as well. We call the business Street Fight, but the URL is Street Fight Mag.
Rafat, I mean, maybe you can. I mean, obviously, you went through this with paid content, and you started this site covering digital media. You realized, okay, ads are only going to get you so far. So you had events, you had jobs. You branched out and tried to offer all the things they're trying to offer. I mean, what would you give her as feedback as far as what kind of the difficulty in kind of starting an online trade publication, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, we started with such a broad. I mean, we started with a niche covering the topic of paid content, right? And then we expanded into a lot of other stuff and ended up being sort of the omnibus site for the whole industry across different industries, across different countries, across different platforms and stuff. And I think that as probably Laura goes along, she will figure out is that slowly sort of broadening the horizon, and as the industry expands and stuff to all things local and all things sort of intersection of publishing and commerce and all the other stuff that she's already thinking about, seems to be the right way to do it. It has to become a daily read. There's no two ways about it, unless it becomes a daily read out of sight, out of mind in these days. So I think
That's
that's
great.
one thing that's something that you'll have to figure out.
And so you're saying that right now you don't see the site as a daily read.
Well, I don't read it, but I'm just saying as you because I'm not in the industry anymore. So don't take my that has nothing against the site because I'm not in the industry anymore.
But I hear what you're saying. I think even with the other revenue streams, you still have to be a daily destination for it to be relevant in people's daily businesses.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a destination. It could be reaching them through email or Twitter or whatever it is. But the value that we learned of being the first read in the morning for a long time, we'd sort of done the way we may have lost it with competitors and all the others that came in. But for the longest time, we were the first thing people woke up to for years and years and years. And that was of huge value to us as a business. And they still, I mean, a lot of people kept coming up to me and met me and said, "You are the first thing I read. You're the first thing I read." And that value for people in the industry was, we were setting the conversation for the industry was a huge thing.
Right. And that's great. That's great to hear because that's sort of how we feel that this is going even in its early days. And that's the direction that we want to go. So we, well, I guess we will study paid content, Rafat, and everything that you did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious. You were at the Standard during this kind of last boom we had. I mean, how much are you seeing that's similar to what we had before? I mean, how much is this kind of, deja vu all over again?
I don't actually feel like it's completely deja vu. I think that we're at a different point in terms of, and I'm looking at the sustainable business model standpoint, and I don't feel like that was really there quite as much before. But at the same time, it does seem like it is a bit of an explosion of new companies around a particular idea. So I don't want to draw too many conclusions. I think there are some parallels.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
So Google has announced at their I/O conference the new Chromebook, which is another new gadget, another new device, another new laptop, kind of a netbook, if you will. It's going to be coming out in mid-June. Samsung and Acer are going to be manufacturing it for Google. There'll be no software. It's going to be instant on. You just turn it on and you're on the web. And if you want any kind of, there's no software. It's just if you want anything, you need to use apps. The pricing is around, I'm seeing $349 to $500, which seems like could be kind of pricey for something that might, be more of a netbook than a laptop. I guess the question is this just going to be roadkill? Is it going to be another kind of Nexus One for Google where they try to jump into something, into hardware, or have they learned their lessons from that?
I think they probably realize that it's a transitory device, And I think they probably learned that lesson well with Google Nexus One. The cost of manufacturing and getting this done these days in China is so cheap and so sort of readily available that it's not like they spend, even though it's a machine and it looks like they probably spend years and years researching it, it's not really, because all this stuff is off the shelf in China and ready to be made in a matter of months, if not weeks. It's the work that they put in probably in the software is of course all they needed to do. So I think my guess is they probably will play it as an experiment and we'll keep playing that. And as we all know, sort of netbooks is giving way to tablets and netbooks have their place and probably will stay a relatively decent size over the years to come. And sort of that's how I'm looking at it.
Do you think it's kind of a Trojan horse in a way to get into the business world? Because the one thing that Google, I mean, it's funny because the Skype thing we talked about before was really Microsoft's trying to keep Google possibly away from Skype. And now we've got Google kind of making an attack on Microsoft in netbooks. And I'm thinking this is much more about software and the cloud, right? Because this is a machine that forces you to use cloud software for everything you do. So it's a given that when you get a Chromebook, you're going to be, you'll be using Chrome, and then you'll be using Google Docs, and all your word processing and everything will be done in the cloud through Google. So this is a complete end around Microsoft. But the price has to be a lot cheaper, I would think.
Probably, and I'm sure they will probably start subsidizing. They're already doing some innovations on $20 a month or something like that, right?
Right. It was $20 per user, I think, in education, and $28 per user in corporate. So
If anything, this will expand. I mean, that alone may expand the market, if it needs expanding, and certainly outside of US and in more developing countries, I'm guessing Google could probably underwrite a lot of this stuff. I mean, the whole $100 laptop concept sort of taken to a logical extreme. So logical conclusion, so to speak. So hopefully they'll be thinking about that long term as well.
Yeah, one of the things that they talk about with this is that it takes one charge and then it's good for the whole day. And there's some, I don't know if there's some battery technology behind that. Maybe that's part of the reason why the cost is a little bit higher, but they're trying to say, you use it. That seems more of a, I don't know if that's a third world or developing country kind of thing as much as it's just a business traveler. You want to have it. You don't want to have to deal with power while you're on the road, while you're in the airplane, etc.
Yes, and some of the netbooks, the one that I own, netbook, a Toshiba netbook, has 8 hours, they say, but it doesn't really last 8 hours these days. It's been with me for about a year now. But yeah, I think, 8 hours to 8 to 11, some of them have started saying, so some of the netbooks. So that's sort of within the industry standard.
Yeah. Do you feel like your netbook, how does the charge compare between your netbook and your iPad?
iPad lasts much longer, especially apparently the iPad 2, which I don't have, but you have that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and the charge seems amazing on that so far. I mean, it hasn't run out on me. I mean, I haven't traveled with it yet long term, so I can't judge, but it does seem like it's got great battery power, battery life, with a lot of, video and graphical, stuff being put on it. So it's got a lot that it has to handle, too.
Yeah, and also I think the leakage factor, which if you haven't plugged in a while, and if it was, say, let's say it was majority charged, and then you leave it for a while, it won't decharge, it won't leak. On iPad, and I've had instances where I was traveling for a month and I came back, and iPad still has the same charge.
Wow.
Or at least a little bit lower. It's crazy.
That's amazing.
I couldn't believe my eyes. I went to Mongolia last year and left the iPad in London at my friend's place and came back three, four weeks later, and then it was still from like 90%, it was down to 70%, and that was it. So that was just incredible.
It's funny, battery technology is really, it seems quirky. Sometimes you find something, like I have this electric shaver now where it basically, I don't have to plug it in, I have to plug it in maybe once every 2 months, and it just keeps its charge for, it feels like, almost forever. And it's like, can I get that battery and put it in a car or something? Like, you know, that specific battery. It's just, sometimes you find these things that are so quirky. And you know, I had my last iPhone, the battery on that was incredible too. Like, it just felt like it never it for me. And I had other people tell me, oh yeah, my battery will run out in the middle of the day, but my battery, it seemed like that battery would just almost never run out on me. And over a few days, sometimes if I didn't plug in, it still was okay. So it's just,
Wow, that
it's,
was
it,
lucky in the part, but yeah.
but it's just that sometimes it's weird about batteries. They can be kind of quirky. But,
Yeah.
you know, with this, getting back to this Chromebook, I mean, yeah, it's going to have to be something where it feels to me like it's going to have to beat every, there's so much that it's competing with. It's going to have to do something better than everything else, right? Whether that's being cheaper, whether it's being easier, faster, better, you know, something's got to stand out.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they've said that they're coming out with offline versions of everything Google, all the Google ecosystem software.
Yeah.
And I think that alone, if they're only releasing it through these netbooks, let's say, I don't know what their plan is, but if their plan is to exclusively, at least for initially, release it through the Google netbook, then that might become something that I may be interested in, especially if I'm traveling, because I'm all within the Google ecosystem, Gmail, Calendar, all the other stuff as well.
You've been assimilated.
I've been yes, I've sold my soul to from Microsoft to Google, yes, and Facebook and
Well,
everybody else.
just get your Chromebook and you'll be fully assimilated at that point.
Yeah, it seems like every time there's a new gadget that we have to somehow buy and put up money for.
Yeah, and we always question it and think like, do we really need that extra thing? And then once we get it, we always feel like we don't. We wish we, you know, wh how could we live without that? Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Media Chwits. I'm Mark Glazer along with Rafat Ali. I want to thank our guest Laura Rich from Street Fight, and also thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Tune in for all the news, events, and polls at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.